From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, here's the news for this day in Maine, Friday, July 8th, 2016. I'm Andrew Catalina, in for Barbara Caridi. And on this day, Maine officials and lawmakers react to the shootings in Dallas, in which five police officers were killed. Attorney General Janet Mills alleges in a complaint that officials knowingly violated the state's open meetings law when it closed a committee meeting to the public. And one English classroom in Maine looks more like a design lab. Those stories and more coming up. Members of Maine's congressional delegation are joining civil rights leaders, law enforcement officials, and others in condemning the sniper attacks that killed five police officers and wounded seven others in Dallas Thursday during a protest over fatal police shootings of black men in Louisiana and Minnesota this week. Susan Sharon reports.
Maine Senator Susan Collins says she's troubled by the appalling violence in Dallas, Baton Rouge, and Minnesota. In a written statement, she said, "We must find ways to rebuild trust in our communities and work to ensure that all Americans, regardless of the color of their skin, feel protected and safe." Senator Angus King said the horrific incidents underline the urgent need to address the issue of deadly force, frequently directed at African American men. But King says vengeance cannot and must not be part of the solution. Maine police showed solidarity with law enforcement officers in Dallas by promoting an image of Texas with a thin blue line on social media. And Lewiston Police Chief Michael Bussier, who is planning to start a new police job in the city of Richardson, which borders Dallas, says he's hoping to attend some of the funerals. Once the grieving is over, Bussier says the nation can focus on next steps.
We need to look later on when things settle down as to what changes, what need to be done, and what types of community dialogue need to happen to make these things less likely.
Even before the Dallas police shootings, a vigil had been planned in Monument Square in Portland Friday evening to honor the latest victims of racial violence. That vigil is scheduled for 7 p.m. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
As expected, Maine Attorney General Janet Mills has filed a complaint in district court charging the Blue Ribbon Commission on Education Reform with violating the state's open meetings law. Mal Leary reports.
The complaint lays out the facts about the creation of the commission to reform public education funding and improve student performance in Maine, the formal name of the group. The complaint states that Dr. Bill Beardsley, the current Deputy Commissioner of Education and Chair of the Commission, willfully and deliberately violated the state's open meetings law. Attorney General Mills says the Department of Education asked her office whether the first meeting of the commission could be closed, as Governor Paul LePage wished, and her answer was clear that it could not.
We allege that there was a willful violation, in good part because they were informed directly, specifically, that the meeting, of course, is a public meeting.
And Mills says Beardsley himself was personally informed by her office that there was no legal way for the commission to meet privately. She says a public body can only close its meetings for very specific reasons that are spelled out in state law, and having a getting-to-know-you session is not one of them.
You're talking about educational policy. This Blue Ribbon Commission specifically is designed to talk about major public policy issues affecting every family in the state of Maine. And to that extent, it's clearly a public meeting.
Mills says the law allows for a fine of $500 for willful violations of the open meetings law, and her office is requesting that be assessed against the commission. She hopes her action sends the clear message that all further meetings of the commission must be open. A spokesman for the Department of Education says Beardsley was unavailable and had no further comment. If Beardsley contests the complaint at a hearing later this month, a judge will set a trial date, or he could just pay the fine. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Exactly what will happen when Fairpoint Communications launches new changes next month to its basic landline phone service is not yet clear. But the state's public advocate and consumer groups hope a series of statewide hearings on the so-called Provider of Last Resort, or POLR, service will lay some concerns to rest. As A.J. Higgins reports, several questions were raised during the first of those hearings Thursday night.
Would they still have access to landline telephone service? Could they wind up paying more each month? Would Fairpoint still be obligated to repair damaged telephone lines? These were among the questions posed by several Bangor area residents at the first hearing. Jane Margeson, executive director of Maine AARP, says most Mainers are in the dark about what will happen on August 28th when Fairpoint no longer has to provide basic telephone service in more than 20 of the state's largest communities.
We are hearing from our membership that there is a lot of confusion about the deregulation in these 22 towns. We're very glad that there are going to be these PUC-hosted meetings, and we will be at every single meeting.
There's also confusion about why customers are confused. During the community meeting, Fairpoint Representative Sarah Davis said AARP's efforts to inform the public caused some of it.
I think people were confused because, in part due to the AARP press release and some other things that had some information that maybe wasn't exactly accurate, that said that if you weren't in these communities, you weren't affected at all. And it's not exactly true. It's a complicated issue.
When asked whether Fairpoint bore any of the responsibility for failing to clearly outline the changes to its basic price-protected landline service, Davis also said the Maine news media could have done a better job.
There's been a lot through the media and other outlets, a lot of miscommunication from media misunderstanding that is driving consumer misunderstanding. The intent was never, for instance, to discontinue landlines, and that seemed to get out in the media a lot.
I'm one of the older people who does not use a cell phone or the internet. It just seems to me that you are leaving us in the lurch.
Pam Taylor of Bangor said she hadn't received any notices from Fairpoint regarding changes to her basic landline service that were authorized this year by the Maine legislature. Fairpoint told lawmakers that it shouldn't have to provide it in nearly two dozen larger communities that have numerous competing options for communications, whether it be cell phone service, cable television telephone service, or other telephone companies. Tim Schneider, Maine's public advocate, told the audience that the thrust of the changes involves relieving Fairpoint of having to seek PUC review if it wants to raise the fixed monthly rates for its POLA landline service.
And they would do a rate case which could last 9 months to increase it even a dollar. And now, after 1 year, they can raise rates and they don't have to ask for permission anymore.
The next PUC hearing on POLR will be from 6 to 7 p.m. on July 13th at Lewiston City Hall. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
Governor Paula Page says he'll once again put forth his selection for Education Commissioner in the new year if he views the new legislature as more favorable. LePage reiterated his position in a letter in which he complained that the current legislature chose to, quote, play politics with his nomination of William Beardsley to run the Education Department. In February, LePage rescinded his nomination and tapped Beardsley to serve as acting commissioner for 6 months, then deputy commissioner. The state agency hasn't had a permanent education commissioner since Jim Ryer left in late 2014. Thursday's letter came after the Maine School Superintendents Association urged him to appoint a permanent education commissioner, saying uncertainty surrounding the position is creating an unstable environment and confusing staff. Maine's legislature will not hold public hearings this year into the conduct of undercover game wardens after a newspaper reported on tactics including providing alcohol and encouraging poaching. One legislator says lawmakers lack the stomach to question law enforcement ahead of elections. Chairs of the committee that oversees the warden service say such hearings wouldn't be useful as long as Maine law prevents disclosing covert operations policy. A Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife spokesman declined to answer whether undercover operations remain suspended following the Maine Sunday Telegram's reveal of an undercover warden's identity. The warden service's commander has said his department doesn't intend to investigate alleged misconduct. Independent State Representative Jeffrey Evangelos of Friendship, a Judiciary Committee member, said he unsuccessfully asked for hearings into possible civil rights violations. Acadia National Park is celebrating its 100th anniversary. Happy birthday, Acadia. The park began its life as the Sir Dumont's National Monument, created on July 8, 1916 by President Woodrow Wilson. It became a national park in 1919 and assumed its current name 10 years later. Later, John D. Rockefeller Jr. directed the construction of the popular network of carriage roads. Acadia was the nation's first national park in the East, and it was the first park created entirely through private donations. The milestone coincides with the creation of the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service next month. The Park Service oversees more than 400 units, including 59 national parks. A group calling itself Equal Rights, Not Special Rights, says it will focus on gathering signatures at polling places this fall. Its measure would remove discrimination based on sexual orientation from Maine's human rights law.
This citizens' initiative, when successful, will simply remove the phrase sexual orientation from the Maine Human Rights Act.
That's Michael Heath, one of the group's organizers. He says they're targeting Election Day because of huge expected turnout.
70-80% of registered voters would be turning out. So in that one day, if we do our homework, if we do our work well, we could gather a large chunk, if not all, of the signatures we need.
But they will have opposition, with Equality Maine pledging to have supporters of the law at polling places urging Mainers not to sign the petition.
We're going to be talking to voters about this issue. You know, the voters 10 years ago made it very clear that they think discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity is wrong. So we're just going to ask them to reiterate that again and hopefully not sign this petition.
That's Matt Moonen, executive director of Equality Maine. He argues Mainers have voted on the issue and don't want to vote on it again. A National Centers for Disease Control report released this week suggests that some of Maine's most iconic industries also see the most deaths by suicide. Farming, fishing, and forest industry workers are committing suicide at the highest rates among the states surveyed, according to the report. Monique Coombs from the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association says she is interested in learning more about the data, since not much is really known about suicide among Maine fishermen. But, she says, knowing what she knows about resource-based industries like fishing and farming, the finding isn't a complete surprise.
It's their whole lifestyle. So if something terrible happens to their job or their boat or something, it's not like they're just losing their 9-to-5 position. There's something, you know, something in their lifestyle is changing.
And, she says, not much exists in the way of outreach and mental health options for self-employed farmers and fishermen, and doubts that many in those industries would ask for help. Additionally, she says aging out of the industry and a lack of retirement resources may play a role.
You know, agriculture and fisheries don't traditionally have like major retirement plans attached to them. So if someone's getting older and they haven't planned for it and things are changing and happening, you know, I think there will be some depression issues there, and that could be a part of that.
The report tracks 17 states' data for 2012, the most recent report year. Maine is not among them, but will be in subsequent reports. The state began reporting those kinds of deaths to the CDC in 2014. The population of Lisbon is expected to swell from 9,000 to nearly 50,000 this weekend for the Moxie Festival. But this year, visitors will find the iconic Old Store, which birthed Maine's peculiar state soda, closed. The 100-year-old Kennebec fruit store, owned for decades by the Anicetti family, has been put up for sale after the current patriarch, Frank Anicetti, recently decided to retire.
Folks here in Lisbon can remember sitting up at the counter and hearing stories from the Anicetti family, especially Frank, who took over the store from his father.
That's Tracy Stuber, Economic and Community Development Director in Lisbon. She says Anicetti was a big champion of Moxie.
He was one that really enjoyed Moxie and started collecting a lot of things that had to do with Moxie.
Stuber says it may be the end of one era, but with so many people coming this weekend, she's hopeful that the property won't stay vacant for long.
We'll see what happens. Who knows? Maybe somebody coming to the festival. We have people from all over that come to town just for this event, and you know, somebody may look at that and say, gosh, I can remember coming into that store, and I really like that, and maybe I'll purchase the building and bring it back again. So,
another local store, Miller's Variety, has taken over the sale of Moxie merchandise. The festival celebrating the soda is now in its 34th year. It starts tonight and lasts through Sunday. If you looked inside Dan Ryder's classroom at Mount Blue High School in Farmington, you might think he taught engineering. A 3D printer sits in the corner, and there's a giant box of Legos and a cart full of electronics right beside. But Ryder teaches English using a method called design thinking, in which he combines books, inventions, and brainstorming to create a new kind of classroom experience. Robbie Feinberg tells us more.
Early on a Friday morning near the end of the school year, Dan Ryder stands in front of his ninth grade English class with a set of directions.
We've got to develop a prototype solution, a solution you believe is going to work.
These student solutions, these prototypes, won't look like posters or models. Instead, Ryder wants these students to take a character, this one from Romeo and Juliet, and figure out what problem they're facing. Then he wants them to design a real solution that could fix it. And these won't just be ideas. These will be real, working prototypes.
So, create, be bold, try things, go!
Quickly, the freshmen dive after Legos and little electronic components called little bits. Soon their prototypes are whirring with lights and sounds. As you watch all this unfold, you've often got to remind yourself that you're still in an English classroom.
I've just found that if I take the approach of what's the best practice for English teaching, I'm locking out a whole world of understanding, and I'm locking out a bunch of transferable skills.
Ryder says he can tap into those transferable skills through an approach known as design thinking. It's been used in business for years, but rarely in education. Ryder's thread of design thinking looks like this. It starts out normally. Students read a book and talk about the ideas inside it. But then things get unusual. Students pick a character and try to empathize with that character to think about the major problems that character must be facing. And then, like an inventor might, students write down all the ways that they might fix that problem. Then they pick one of their solutions, and with the help of 3D printers, Legos, and little bits, students actually create their solutions. It all comes down to problem solving.
Because, I mean, literacy isn't just comprehension, it's also making meaning and using to solve problems. And that's what the design thinking lets you do.
Ryder developed all these methods about 3 years ago when he was growing frustrated with his teaching. Specifically, he kept asking kids to make posters and projects that looked nice but didn't really show deep learning. But then Ryder stumbled across design thinking online, and he saw that by using methods traditionally associated with engineering, students are forced to go deep into the literature to think about characters, motives, deeper issues, and how they connect to real life. After only about 45 minutes in the classroom, the results speak for themselves. One group has created a system of sensors meant to detect when too much fighting is going on between the Montagues and Capulets. Meanwhile, sophomore Zach Davis has made a device to monitor Romeo's heartbeat and calm him down to help him make more rational decisions.
This could be his heartbeat. We turn it all the way up.
But Davis says transitioning to this new kind of learning wasn't easy. He says it took time for him to realize that he wasn't just playing around with Legos, but thinking about literature in a new way.
You know, you read it just as this, you read it as just a story, but when you actually put it into physical form, it gives you a better sense and it gives you a better idea of, you know, what you read or what, you know, what's going on in your mind.
Matt Druitt-Card is the curriculum instruction assessment coordinator for the Dexter School District. Druitt-Card says in the big picture of education, design thinking is still a niche, mostly used in classes like science and engineering. But he says Ryder's approach of blending all that together into a traditional English curriculum is novel.
But again, you peel back the layers, he's doing what no one else is really doing, that I know of in the very few people in the country, this hands-on, authentic learning, but he's doing it in AP English.
In Maine, the private Gould Academy in Bethel has started adopting design thinking into its own curriculum through a new facility called the Ideas Center. And other schools in Dover, Foxcroft, and Dexter have recently started implementing it among administrators to brainstorm new ideas and approaches. But in terms of learning, design thinking in Maine is still mostly limited to Ryder's classroom so far. Sarah Schifferin, the director of Gould's Ideas Center, says the challenge comes down to properly training teachers and not shoving the new approach down their throats.
You know, how do we integrate design thinking in a way that's not so disruptive that they're not going to want to use it?
Dan Ryder says he still struggles with this disruption, too. He worries by focusing so much on these prototypes, he may not be doing enough to help his students with traditional English skills, such as writing. But in the rapidly changing world of academics, Ryder is confident that new and traditional methods can work together. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And that's the news on this day in Maine, Friday, July 8th, 2016. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders Keith Shortall and Susan Sharon, and to Robbie Feinberg, AJ Higgins, Mal Leary, and Jennifer Mitchell for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes or email us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Andrew Catalina. For all of us here at Maine Public Broadcasting, thanks for listening.